Welcome to the McQuaid Arcade Podcast. I'm Scott.
And I'm Biggs.
If asked to name a single pop culture reference that serves as the quintessential expression of the consumerism and materialism of the 1980s, most people would probably, I think, choose Greed is Good, Gordon Gekko's famous line from the 1987 film Wall Street. But here at McQuaid Arcade, we'd argue that that distinction actually goes to three words first spoken by a retired manicurist in 1984.
Where's the beef?
On this episode, we're talking about our favorite television commercials from the 1980s. Some of them, anyway. With the number of memorable TV ad campaigns we saw growing up, we'll almost certainly have to do another follow-up episode or two. Before we get into the commercials themselves, though, let's talk about the state of TV advertising in the 80s and the factors that affected it, some of which will go on to change commercials forever. While cable TV certainly wasn't new in the 1980s, it's been around since 1948, it saw significant expansion that decade, and that alone changed the TV commercial game. More channels, after all, meant more commercials, and more specialized channels meant the potential for more really targeted advertising. But one of those new channels in particular would go on to influence American pop culture to such a degree that it single-handedly revolutionized TV commercials. The influence of MTV and music videos in general on TV advertising in the 80s is undeniable. In fact, in doing research for the show, I found entire courses dedicated to the subject, but my favorite breakdown of the MTV effect comes from a 1989 New York Times article titled How MTV Has Rocked Television Commercials. It's such a cool read, and my favorite bit sounds like it could have been written today about the internet, especially apps like TikTok. It says, quote, MTV's impact, first and foremost, is as a teacher, said Philip B. Dusenberry, chairman and chief executive of BBDO New York, the ad agency for Pepsi-Cola and Apple Computer. It has educated people, particularly young people, to accept lots of information in a short period of time. There were also technical tricks and techniques used by MTV and the videos they played that began to be incorporated into commercials as well.
Let's dive into some of those technical tricks because they really act as the fulcrum for a lot of this rapid change. MTV began broadcasting in the summer of 1981. Now, I'm not an expert on this by any stretch, but the language of music videos is distinctly different from conventional film and television. Lightning fast cuts between images, slow motion, vibrant, larger than life colors, and of course, the music. In thinking about this, one can see a very direct lineage to TikTok, Instagram Reels, and the like. But in that long lineage, we have an entire world of marketing that seized upon this new language and took that world to new heights. It's weird. I don't listen to a lot of music these days. I tend to have a podcast or an audible book playing when I have a moment. But I realize the way I do get to listen to music is when it's paired with short videos on Instagram Reels. Atmospheric advertising. The idea of conveying a vibe without really selling anything directly, think beer commercials, seems to be part of this through line. And it was made technically feasible by the explosion of computers leading to tremendous innovation with special effects, new cinematographic techniques, and better quality productions all around. CGI, or computer-generated imagery, started to become more accessible to everyone, including advertisers, enabling them to create immersive, visually captivating ads that were previously impossible. I recently watched this fantastic documentary called Jurassic Punk, which is hilarious. It's the story of Steve Williams, who's been described as a genius man-child. He studied classical animation and computer engineering at the University of Toronto. And I have to take a moment to fanboy for a second because this makes me think of a famous Steve Jobs quote. Quote, it's in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough. It's technology married with liberal arts, married with the humanities, that yields us the results that make our hearts sing. Unquote. I love that. Well, Steve Williams was doing some interesting stuff and Industrial Light and Magic got wind of his ability to combine animation, computing, and fluid dynamics, which led him to become the key animator for the unforgettable water tentacle scene in one of my all-time favorite movies, Jim Cameron's 1989 masterpiece, The Abyss. In the documentary, they really showcased just how wild and new all this was. They literally could not do the scene they wanted, and Steve Williams essentially created it from whole cloth. It's really an intense documentary. I highly recommend it. It's actually really depressing. He goes through a big bout of alcoholism, but it ends kind of on a positive note. Now, two very specific points I wanted to make. First, the advent of non-linear editing, or NLE, systems towards the end of the 80s really began to change the way commercials, and frankly all of this kind of media, were edited. Unlike traditional linear editing, which required editing scenes in sequence on a physical film or tape, you know, the old-fashioned way, NLE systems allowed editors to access any part of the video footage digitally and make changes instantly. And this is very much how we do it today. When you're doing something on a computer, you can just go anywhere you want at any time you want. You can copy and paste and do things. You're not using physical scotch tape to actually put things together. And this flexibility streamlined the editing process and opened up new creative possibilities for crafting atmospheric narratives, as editors could experiment more freely with different arrangements of scenes, transitions, and effects to achieve the desired emotional impact. This is a fundamental change that I truly believe allowed people to, excuse the Apple reference again, think different. The second point is that not only were totally new ways of conceptualizing and working on projects available for the first time in human history, but that the access to these technologies was democratizing at an insane rate as the computer revolution was gaining steam.
The consumer culture of the 80s also led to a big increase in celebrity endorsements in commercials, movies, and TV stars. Musicians, famous athletes, all paid big bucks to endorse all kinds of products. Michael Jordan, Bruce Willis, Cindy Crawford, Bill Cosby, David Bowie, Michael J. Fox, Demi Moore. I mean, the biggest stars on the planet at the time were hawking everything from cars to shoes to soft drinks on TV. The king of pop himself, Michael Jackson, even caught his hair on fire in a now famous iconic TV spot for Pepsi.
Too soon. It's too soon.
So if you look at all this, it's clearly not just nostalgia that we're looking at here, right? Commercials in the 80s really were different than anything that had come before. One phenomenon that, like cable TV, certainly wasn't new in the 80s, but definitely brought to a new level and sort of changed forever in the 80s, was the mascot. The character created specifically to promote products in TV commercials. And when we're talking about 80s TV mascots, or maybe TV mascots in general, I don't think it gets much bigger than the California Raisins. There's no better example of a marketing initiative that transcended its original purpose to become a significant part of pop culture than the Raisins. The California Raisins ad campaign was developed for the California Raisin Advisory Board to promote raisins, a major agricultural product of California. They needed a fresh new campaign to appeal to young people, one entertaining and exciting enough to distract kids from the fact that raisins are gross. Their previous slightly less successful slogan was, "Hey kids, do you like grapes but wish they were just a little bit more like eating a booger? Try raisins." Now, I know plenty of people like raisins, but when you were a kid in the 80s and your Alf lunchbox was full of garbage like Ecto Cooler and Nerds and Cool Ranch Doritos, raisins were a tough sell. The ad agency Foot, Cone, and Belding, spearheaded by copywriter Seth Warner, came up with the idea of anthropomorphized raisins singing and dancing to soul music. And I think it's safe to say that that particular musical choice played an immeasurable part in the campaign's success. We've talked about the power of soundtracks before on the show many times, and just like the movie Predator, through its soundtrack, is responsible for our love of the song Long Tall Sally and the music of Little Richard in general, which we normally wouldn't have listened to as kids in the 80s, the Raisins turned us on to Motown.
It really is remarkable. Commercials are supposed to, at best, speak to the culture. But here we are witnessing commercials shaping culture. I don't know if we'll ever see this happen again, at least to this extent, in large part because the entire nature of advertising has shifted. Today, people really aren't exposed to commercials in a way anything like it used to be.
Seth Warner, again, he's the guy who came up with the whole concept for this campaign, not only nailed it with the music, but the medium as well. If you think about it, the Raisins very easily could have been traditionally animated, right? They could have been a cartoon, but instead they were brought to life by Will Vinton Studios through the painstaking process of stop motion clay animation, or claymation, a term coined by Will Vinton himself. Now, by the time the first California Raisins commercial aired in 1986, we'd seen and loved plenty of stop motion animation in movies. We had the amazing work of Ray Harryhausen in one of our favorites, Clash of the Titans, all three original Star Wars movies, Dragon Slayer. But this was not a technique often used in commercials, probably because it was an absolutely incredible amount of work. The first Raisins commercial apparently took about a month to shoot, and it involved hiring actual human dancers to use as models for the animation of the Raisins. The work paid off, though, because The claymation gave all of the Raisins such personality that they were an instant hit with viewers, including us. We loved them. Like every other kid in the 80s, we had Raisins toys.
I even had little Raisin figurines and that super cool hand puppet that lived on my shelf for all those years.
We had the toys, we watched the cartoon, and we, like literally millions of other people, bought the albums. The Raisins put out four albums, and two of them went platinum. Their version of I Heard It Through the Grapevine cracked the Billboard Top 100. The Raisins even had their own holiday TV special. And they were from a commercial. They didn't start as a cartoon or a toy or a comic book. They advertised dried fruit. Very well, I might add, because after the Raisins first hit TV, Raisin sales jumped 20%. They weren't the first commercial mascots or the first mascots to have toys and merchandise, but the Raisins were the first commercial mascots we loved despite not caring about the actual product. Right? We liked Ronald McDonald and the Fry Guys because we liked McDonald's. We liked Tony the Tiger and the Trix Rabbit and Count Chocula because we loved sugary cereal. We loved the Raisins because they were cool and fun to watch and the music was great. Everybody loved them, even Ray Charles and Michael Jackson, who both got in on the claymation action with appearances in California Raisin commercials. Michael Jackson even had his own pelvis-thrusting, sequin-gloved-wearing Raisin character. Do Raisins have pelvises? The same year the Raisins commercial first aired, another ad campaign, one that was almost certainly inspired by their success, hit TV with its own Will Vinton animated claymation character.
This is the Noid. He loves to ruin your pizza. If you've ever gotten cold pizza, a squashed pizza, or pizza that just wasn't ripe, the Noid did it. But at Domino's Pizza, we avoid the Noid.
The Noid, the ad says, is responsible for bad pizzas being delivered. He's the personification of everything that could go wrong with a pizza delivery. It shows the little red rabbit-eared gremlin destroying pizzas bound for delivery. He's smashing them, freezing them, until, of course, he gets to the Domino's pizza, which is immune to his pizza putrefying powers. And while the Noid certainly had, he had some cultural cachet at the time, for sure. Like the Raisins, he had toys and even his own video games. He definitely did not have the same level of cultural impact. He impacted me personally, though. I worked at a Domino's in the 90s shortly after high school. I was a Dominoid, as we called ourselves. That's the little nickname for Domino's employees. And that's where the name The Noid came from. They just shortened it to Noid from our cute little nickname, Dominoids. As the new guy, I was forced to do jobs that other employees didn't want to do. The worst and most traumatic of which was wearing the store's Noid costume out in front of the store and dancing around like a buffoon to entice passersby to come on in for a mediocre pizza. It was a big costume too. The size, like, it was like a sports team mascot suit, and it was hot. I wore that horrible costume for days out in the sweltering Chicago summer sun. Apparently the last employee doomed to be sealed up in it, like I was, like the man in the iron mask, had passed out and thrown up in it. In which order, I'm not sure, but it definitely smelled like barf and fear inside that horrible suit.
That's my favorite quote of all time. We might need a t-shirt that says, it smelled like barf and fear.
Hey, if you would like your very own barf and fear t-shirt, head on over to McQuaidArcade.com, because by the time this show airs, our brand new merch store should be live on our website. No barf and fear t-shirt yet. Perhaps it's in the works.
Stay tuned.
But you can get, stay tuned. You can get your official McQuaid Arcade t-shirt and other fun stuff. Check it out, McQuaidArcade.com. While the Noid didn't take the world by storm the same way the Raisins did, it was definitely a very successful ad campaign and gave Domino's a leg up on their would-be pizza delivery rival, Pizza Hut. Now, Pizza Hut at the time was the largest pizza chain in the country, but their business model was based on dine-in restaurants. In 1986, they began to focus on delivery and faced a tough battle against Domino's, the largest deliverer of pies in the U.S., who spent a ton of money on campaigns like this one that had the public convinced that they were the ones to go to if you hoped to be handed a pizza unmolested by the Noid. But in 1989, the Noid would be the focal point of what a foodandwine.com article calls, quote, the worst mascot public relations disaster in history. From that article, it was a typical Monday lunch hour when 22-year-old Kenneth Lamar Noid walked into the Domino's Pizza in Chamblee, Georgia, clutching a .357 Magnum revolver. He took two employees hostage for more than 5 hours, who were able to escape. This is my favorite part. When Noid ordered and ate a pizza.
Oh my goodness.
Luckily, no one was hurt during the ordeal. According to police officers on the scene, Noid had become convinced that the pizza chain's marketing campaign had been aimed directly at him. He adamantly thought that the owner of Domino's Pizza was telling people to steer clear of him. While Noid was charged, he was ultimately found not guilty of the crimes by reason of insanity and was sent to Georgia's Mental Health Institute. In 1995, still convinced that Domino's Pizza was out to make his life miserable, Kenneth Lamar Noid died by suicide in his Florida apartment. The pizza chain immediately stopped using the Noid in their marketing thereafter, end quote.
Holy guacamole. That escalated quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Right. In preparation for the show, I listened to a fascinating podcast on theworld.org about the Domino's hostage situation that features interviews from some of the people involved, including the employee who made Noid the pizza that he demanded. It was an extravaganza, apparently. The kind of pizza he made, I mean, not the situation in general.
Oh my goodness.
The pizza was called an extravaganza. And according to Domino's executive on the podcast who remembers when all this happened, the campaign, the Noid campaign, had actually run its course by the time Noid, the man, sadly took his own life, kind of contrary to the take in the Food and Wine article that the suicide was the reason the Noid disappeared from TV. He's back, though, apparently, or at least he was a couple of years ago when he was part of a new Domino's social media campaign, including an appearance in a Crash Bandicoot video game. Personally, my favorite Domino's ad campaign was from about 15 years ago, where they basically said, look, we know our pizza is bad, but we'll try and make it better. We promise. This was known as their pizza turnaround campaign, and it was launched after their pizza was ranked by a survey conducted by a consumer research firm as tied for dead last place among pizza chains with Chuck E. Cheese. And that pizza is made by a rat. So they were probably right to reevaluate. Hey, fun fact, do you know what the E in Chuck E. Cheese stands for?
No.
Ew.
I believe it.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
So I've made a few Apple allusions so far, and yes, I am a bit of a fanboy, but I've earned it. I'm no fairweather fan. I got my first Macintosh around 1989, and I toughed out the miserable 90s when there wasn't even an iPod. That was back when Jobs wasn't even the CEO and things were really bleak. But before those dark times, there was the famous 1984 commercial directed by Sir Ridley Scott of Alien and Blade Runner fame. A beautiful article in 9to5 Mac celebrated the 40th birthday of this iconic commercial recently. Aaron Wachulis writes, quote, on this day 40 years ago, Apple's first Macintosh went on sale, just 2 days after being introduced to the world during a commercial break in the third quarter of Super Bowl XVIII. Although 1984 became a cultural phenomenon and a watershed moment for product launches, Apple's board of directors was against it from the start, unquote. It's really a remarkable achievement because it led to Apple instantly becoming a household name. Inspired by George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984, it was a remarkably bold jab at the then-current PC market, in particular IBM. Just before being caught, the athlete wearing a sweet Macintosh tank top throws a sledgehammer at Big Brother's screen right after he declares, "We shall prevail." It's powerful stuff. But apparently, it almost didn't happen. The article goes on to say, quote, when Steve Jobs first saw the ad in an internal meeting with Chiat Day, his first reaction was, oh shit, this is amazing. Then Apple CEO John Sculley told Business Insider. Steve Wozniak shared the same opinion, calling it, quote, better than any science fiction trailer, unquote. Apple's board of directors, however, had very different thoughts. After seeing it for the first time, board member Mike Markulis suggested finding a new marketing agency and firing Chiat Day. According to Sculley, other members of the board had similar opinions. The others just looked at each other, dazed expressions on their faces, most of them felt it was the worst commercial they had ever seen. Not a single outside board member liked it.
Wow.
Fortunately for Apple and for us, they decided to run it, and the rest is history.
It certainly is a big bun. It's a very big bun. Big fluffy bun.
It's a very big fluffy bun.
Where's the beef?
Some hamburger places give you a lot less beef on a lot of bun.
Where's the beef?
At Wendy's, we serve a hamburger we modestly call a single. And Wendy's single has more beef than the Whopper or Big Mac. At Wendy's, you get more beef and less bun.
Hey, where's the beef? I don't think there's anybody back there.
You want something better. You're Wendy's kind of people.
Much like the aforementioned battle between Domino's and Pizza Hut for pizza delivery supremacy, the fast food burger wars raged throughout the 80s, with chains like McDonald's and Burger King fighting for mindshare through various TV ad campaigns. But it was Wendy's that was responsible for quite possibly the most memorable TV slogan in advertising history. With those three little words uttered in 1984, Wendy's began the tradition of throwing shade at its competitors that continues to this very day on Twitter. In the iconic TV spot, three elderly women find themselves at a fast food burger place that proclaims itself to be home of the big bun when the giant fluffy bun is pulled aside to reveal a comically tiny burger. One of the women inquires as to the whereabouts of the burger itself. That woman was Clara Peller, who worked as a manicurist right here in Chicago for 35 years. The campaign was an instant success, resulting in a more than 30% increase in revenue for the chain. It went on to spawn several sequel commercials and merchandising bearing Peller's catchphrase was everywhere. Presidential hopeful Walter Mondale even used the phrase during the 1984 Democratic primary campaign to question the substance of rival Gary Hart's policy.
That is peak 80s right there, baby. That's right. It.
Apparently, the line was supposed to be, "Where is all the beef?" But since Peller suffered from emphysema, she wasn't able to quite get all that out in one breath, so she shortened it. Just a year after she took the world by storm, though, the burger chain cut ties with Peller after she dared to publicly state that she had, in fact, found the beef. You see, she wasn't referring to one of Wendy's trademark square burger patties, but a jar of pasta sauce.
I found it.
Real beef. It's in there, in new Prego Plus spaghetti sauce with beef and onions.
I really found it.
Prego Plus, with chunks of ground sirloin beef. Lots of beef.
I finally found it.
It's spaghetti sauce.
In a 1985 commercial for Prego Plus pasta sauce, Peller declared she'd found it. And a voiceover made it clear that she was, in fact, talking about the beef. And as a result, she was dropped by Wendy's as a spokesperson because, as everyone knows, you know, the beef can't possibly be in two places at once. In 1987, Peller passed away at the age of 86, and her obituary in the August 12th edition of the Chicago Tribune notes that, quote, "Mrs. Peller, a widow, lived alone for many years in furnished rooms at the Belmont Hotel and spent much of her time drinking coffee with friends at McDonald's."
She showed them.
There are two ways to shop for carpeting. You can get dressed and go out and brave the traffic or the yell of the bus and find a showroom and wait for a salesman and try to remember the size of your rooms and the exact colors you want to match and put in your order and fight your way back home and wait days or weeks or months for your carpet to be delivered and installed. Or you can just pick up the phone and call Empire.
588-2300-EMPIRE.
So far, we've talked about commercials seen across the country, perhaps even the world. Another thing that set TV advertising in the 80s apart was the trend towards the globalization of advertising campaigns. Major brands began to create ads that could easily be adapted for different markets around the world. But another big part of our TV watching childhoods was the local TV commercial, and we had plenty of classics here in the greater Chicagoland area, like the one you just heard for Empire Carpet, now a national company known as Empire Today. And if you're familiar with Empire, but not from Chicago, the version of their famous phone number jingle we just played no doubt sounds a bit different than what you're used to. And that's because it's from back before they shoehorned in the toll-free 800 prefix into the jingle, which happened back in 1995. Growing up, the commercials featured the famous Empire Man as its spokesperson. The Empire Man was a gentleman named Elmer Lynn Haldren. In 1977, he created the concept of the Empire Man campaign for the company, but couldn't find the right actor for the job. Owen Seymour Cohen who founded Empire in 1959, asked Haldren to perform the role himself, and the rest is Chicago history. Haldren continued to voice the Empire Man character after the company transitioned to an animated version of the commercial, and he was a pretty fascinating guy, a real Renaissance man. He was a World War II hero, a copywriter who went on to start his own firm, and he sang in a barbershop quartet called Cordiac Arrest. He actually wrote the tune of the famous Empire jingle himself, too. We grew up seeing his trademark glasses and mustache on TV pretty much every single day. In a tournament-style poll on Axios.com, Empire emerged victorious as Chicago's best TV commercial of all time, beating out some very stiff competition, like Solozzi Edelson Chevrolet, where...
You always save more money.
Moo and Oink, our famous grocery store chain, Mr. Submarine, and of course, Victory Auto Wreckers. The old commercial where the guy goes to open his car door and it falls off in his hands. That went toe-to-toe with Empire in the final round.
Those local commercials are particularly special because they tended to air in the middle of the day, and for us at least, they are inextricably linked with early childhood. They also have caused us some confusion because it really was hard to know what was a local Chicagoland area thing and what was part of the national zeitgeist. Now, we have really moved to more of a national monoculture, even a global monoculture in some ways, but there's a tension around this, and perhaps it's fragmenting again. If so, it's far less likely to be due to regional geography and far more likely to be related to the social media we consume and the algorithms that shape our media and thus, in a very real sense, our experience of the world. A piece from 2019 in Vox by Kyle Chaika had some very choice thoughts on this. Quote, within the monoculture obsession, there are two concerns. The first is that in the digital streaming era, we have lost a perceived ability to connect over media products as reference points that everyone knows. The way that we used to discuss the weather or politics, at least in a bygone time before our realities were split by climate change and Fox News. The fear is that we exist in a fragmented realm of impenetrable niches and subcultures enabled by streaming media, unquote. He goes on to say, quote, the second concern is that because of the pressures of social media and the self-reinforcing biases of recommendation algorithms that drive streaming, culture is becoming more similar than different. We are worried that our digital niches cause a degree of homogenization, which the word monoculture is also used to describe, unquote. Now, he went on to write this excellent book called Filter World, How Algorithms Flatten Culture, that continues with this thesis, and it's an excellent read for anybody interested. Here's the other side of the story. Paul Cantor's seminal article on Medium back in 2013 had a lot to chew on in the other direction. Quote, they said everything would splinter into a million small niches, that everyone would have a voice, that if you had talent or had something to say, you could be seen or heard. They lied. The internet as we once knew it, the promise of democracy, where even the little person could carve out his or her own niche, is dead. In its place, we have the meteoric rise of what we thought we once said goodbye to years ago. The monoculture, unquote. So this is tricky to me, and it's not clearly a bad thing. In fact, I feel like we're stuck betwixt and between two concepts, neither of which is necessarily good or bad. On the one hand, it's undeniable that neighborhood-like units of people with particular customs, patterns, likes, and dislikes is charming and enriching. On the other, it's hard to argue that having a smaller world where we feel connected with everyone on the planet could help us potentially to align with bigger endeavors that ultimately can affect us all. It de-silos us to some degree and allows us to share in our humanness. There are few places that play with these concepts like commercials have done and continue to do.
We've talked a lot so far about the technical and stylistic changes traditional TV advertising underwent in the 80s, but the decade also saw the birth of a new kind of TV advertising, the 30-minute infomercial.
Infomercials in the 80s marked a significant evolution in both television broadcasting and advertising strategies and are deeply embedded into the cultural fabric of the decade. The rise of the infomercial as a novel format that combined entertainment with direct marketing was made possible by the deregulation of the television industry and the expansion of cable television. Under the Reagan administration, there was a loosening of regulations that allowed for longer ads. This in turn allowed the half-hour infomercial format to emerge and thrive. Technology also served as an important backdrop in at least two ways. First, we had the fact that there were many new technologies that were ripe for direct-to-consumer ads, and to some degree necessitated a longer, more thorough educational format to make their case and explain the product. I think that the Ronco products by Avuncular founder Ron Papil, masterfully represent here. The tech itself, for example, the Showtime Rotisserie and Barbecue, it's a bigger ticket item. It requires more demonstration, more discussion, and despite the magnificent simplicity of set it and forget it being the thing we remember. Ron passed away in 2021, and an article in ABC7Chicago.com puts it in a nice perspective. In 1959, he appeared in his first TV commercial, hawking the Ronco Chop-O-Matic Food Dicer. Debuting the earnestly dramatic style that became his trademark, Pupil said, "I'm going to show you the greatest kitchen appliance ever made." Pupil followed with a flurry of other made-for-TV inventions, dizzying in both their number and variety. They included the Pocket Fisherman, Mr. Microphone, and the Electric Food Dehydrator. Pupil said he was not just a salesman, but also an inventor who designed many of the products himself. Although his company Ronco was already a household name in the 1970s, Pupil's fame exploded in the 80s when looser federal regulations on TV ads allowed him to go from brief commercials to 30-minute self-contained infomercials, which soon dominated late-night and weekend schedules, unquote. It's fascinating that the seeds of this approach were planted decades prior, but regulatory change allowed them to sprout and grow vigorously.
Hey, this Christmas party's getting a little too quiet. I think it's time we liven it up with my favorite Christmas gift, Mr. Microphone.
Hey, what's that?
Well, you set the dial on your FM radio and testing.
I'm on the radio.
These kids are having a fabulous time with Mr. Microphone, the cordless microphone.
One of the wonders of our universe is that there are lots of metaphors and macrocosm-microcosm pairs that really do seem to make sense. The phrase, as above, so below, originates from the Hermetic tradition, which is encapsulated in the Hermetic texts, particularly the Emerald Tablet. It suggests a correspondence or a reflection between the macrocosm, the universe, and the microcosm, the individual. Commercials often play with these ideas, that we are all connected, part of something bigger and grander. And yet, at the same time, we are all separate, rugged individuals, toughing it out on our own. Of course, they paint the appropriate picture whenever it serves to sell something. Don Draper in the acclaimed show Mad Men sums up advertising beautifully. Quote, "You know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams reassurance that whatever you are doing is okay. You are okay," unquote. Commercials reflect us and the culture around us, while at the same time they actively shape both. This is why they are such delicious little time capsules that convey so much with so little and continue to serve as magical windows into the spirit of a time. And on that note, stay limber.